Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Yeah, Joel, as always, we have five listener questions that we're going to answer on this episode. We've got a long-distance landlording question. We've got a question out of Philly as to whether or not bankruptcy is a good move or not for them. And we have a listener asking how she can get her sister invested in her Roth IRA. So we'll share our thoughts on those questions plus a couple others.
Should be fun as always, man.
Yeah, how you doing today, Joel?
I'm freaking phenomenal, my friend. Glad to be here with you. More than anything, it's nice to get together with my best buddy, have a beer, talk about money. I mean, that's why we started this thing.
Yeah, that's right, man. I wanted to share something real quick with you. I noticed the other day, got home from Target, and I looked at the receipt. And at the bottom of the receipt, there was a little notice on there, and I saw the letters HSA. The antenna went up, right? That caught my attention because I thought, what? What's this about an HSA? And Target is now, I don't know how long they've been doing this, but they are putting the total amount that you may have spent on HSA eligible goods at the bottom of the receipt. It's just a little notice. It gets your attention. And they're also including the amount of tax that you pay as well. And so that's just great that they are making it easier to keep track of these expenses. We recently did an episode on HSAs. Pretty much the only thing that sucks about HSAs is that you have to keep up with receipts. And it's going to be even tougher, say, if you go to the store and you have a bunch of stuff mixed into the receipt. It's a lot of paperwork. But when they have it broken down like that at the bottom for purchases that are going to be potentially reimbursable, that will allow you to pull money out of your HSA down the road, man, I saw that as a huge win. Made me think that some folks over at Target are listening to our podcast and thought, you know, this is something that we can do for our customers.
Well, I hope they are listening. And if they are, thanks, Target folks. And I got to say, that's another check in the box for a reason my wife would be like, yeah, let's go to Target today because she loves Target. So,
man, who doesn't?
And man, I got to say, my friend David came up to me after he listened to the HSA episode and he said, it's completely changed the way he's investing his money. He's putting more money into his HSA.
Nice.
And he's starting to invest that money instead of letting it just sit there. So yeah, HSAs, super cool. And Target helping those folks with an HSA out very nicely.
Did you ever say Target, you know, get all bougie with it? I feel like 10 years ago, folks were saying Target, but I wasn't into it.
No, that wasn't me. But I hear people say it from time to time. It's like calling Atlanta Hotlanta. Just don't do it.
Yeah, don't
just
do that. That's just the don't worst. Do it.
All right, Matt, let's mention the beer that we're having on this episode. Today on the show, we're having Moku Imperial IPA by Lanikai Brewing Company out of Hawaii. And listener Cody sent this one our way. So, Cody, aloha. And thank you for sending this one to us, dude. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Cody. We're looking forward to talking about this one at the end of the episode.
All right, Matt, let's get on to the topic at hand. We're taking listener questions. And if you've got a question you would like Matt and I to tackle on the show, we'd be happy to do it. You can submit your question quite easily just by going to howtomoney.com/ask. And we'd love to feature your question in an upcoming episode. But let's get to the first one for this week right now.
How's it going, guys? My name's Forrest and I live in Littleton, Colorado. I have a question about a real estate versus market investment. My wife Felicia and I bought a townhouse 5 years ago, and we've decided that we want to move to the beach, but don't know whether we should sell the house and invest the profits or keep it as a rental property. The remaining principal is $145,000, but the estimated value is $275,000. Market rent is around $1,650 in our neighborhood. The move is going to be after I pay my student loan and car off and my wife graduates from college. We're hoping only two more winters, with Felicia's student loan being our only debt at that point. We're split on whether to keep or sell and are curious what you think. Thanks.
Hey, Forrest, thanks so much for submitting your question. You know, the Colorado real estate market has been hot up there where you are, but the beach is also a great place to be. So we think that's a fantastic move.
Yeah, what's hotter? A Florida beach in the summer or the Colorado real estate market, man?
They're both pretty warm these days.
True that.
And what's funny is that he mentioned two more winters. Like, there's only two more winters left. It's very clear that they don't like the cold. So moving to the beach, I think, is a great move for you and your wife.
Yeah, when you talk about time in terms of winters like that, we know where your priorities lie, right?
It sounds like Game of Thrones, like only two more winters. Do they say that?
I don't know. I've never seen the show.
Me neither. It's not one of our shows.
But I hear great things.
Yeah.
except for about that final episode, man. A lot of people hated that final episode.
So if you're not there yet, spoiler alert, it was okay.
All right, so let's get to Forrest's question. And should he sell this house, Matt, or should he rent it out as he's completely moving away from there? Like, what do you think?
Yeah, something important worth mentioning, though, is that Forrest, he said that when they sold that they would invest that money in the market. So either way, it's a win-win.
Yeah, if they were going to spend that money on like a couple vacations or a new car, no, keep the house.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but investing it either way, that's a smart move.
Yeah, so because of that, this becomes a lifestyle question, right? More than anything else. Do you want to become a landlord? And specifically, do you want to become a long-distance landlord, which is a difficult thing to figure out when you've never done it before?
Yeah, long-distance landlording kind of comes with its own set of issues or obstacles to overcome. It's completely different than landlording locally. So really, in my opinion, selling is the most straightforward thing that you could do. You won't have to manage a property from long distance, and you avoid having to find and hire a really good property manager. Property managers typically take the first month's rent and then 10% of ongoing rents for your place. So it can be really expensive. It can add up over time, and it can really cut into the profits that you receive for having an investment property.
And if you sell that primary home, that just ensures that you'll pocket those earnings tax-free. Those capital gains, you won't be taxed on that, which is very nice. And again, that is because it is your primary residence. And so you have up to $500,000 that is sheltered from those capital gains tax.
Yeah, that's a really sweet perk, right? That people don't think about when they do decide to rent out a primary home. I mean, we've talked about on the show before, we think that's actually the best, the easiest way to get into landlording is to own a home first, live in it, then move and rent out the home that you were just living in. That's kind of how I got started. And I think it makes a lot of sense for would-be first-time landlords. But if you're moving out of state and you have that additional set of hurdles, well, it might make more sense to sell the home because you can pocket that gain tax-free. And long-distance real estate can be difficult to own. If you decide that it isn't for you after a couple of years, well, it could be more difficult to sell that home from far away. And then on top of that, you might incur those tax consequences that you wouldn't have if you'd sold it immediately.
Yeah, Joel. And what's too long is if you rent that property for more than 3 of the past 5 years. Forrest, if you did want to give landlording a shot, even with it being long distance, you want to make sure that you have lived in that home at least 2 of the past 5 years. That's just what the IRS requires. And as long as you meet that guideline, you are still able to protect those capital gains and you are not taxed on that. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, so you could give it a shot for a short period of time, see how it goes. Maybe it's worth dipping your toes in the water and seeing whether it's worth it or not. But just make sure you don't hold on to it too long. I'd make sure I sold the home before that window closed in order to avoid that tax.
Yeah, you'd hate to miss that by just a couple months, right?
Oh yeah, that'd be super frustrating. So maybe an idea here is during these 2 winters, right, that you're going to still be in Colorado, is to keep saving and then to sell this house when you move. And then when you arrive at your beach destination, consider buying a primary and a rental house when you get there, or maybe even like a multifamily and do some house hacking. There are so many options, and I'm not necessarily completely against long distance landlording. I think it works in some cases. And the numbers that you mentioned, they're not amazing, but they're not terrible. So it just doesn't seem particularly compelling. If I was you, I would look for something close by where you're going to be, something that you can keep an eye on and potentially self-manage. That just makes a little more sense to me as you're moving to a faraway location from where you currently are.
Nice, Joel. Yeah, great point. Maybe to provide one more counterpoint, though, because we love talking about real estate, is that keep in mind that you would be able to diversify your real estate holdings. So, you know, having a property there in Colorado, I couldn't think of anything more distant from the mountains than the beach. So just keep that in mind. That's another benefit, diversification. So Joel, on that note, for you, beach house or mountain house?
Ooh, so because I'm married and want to stay married, I would say beach house. I'd have to. But if it was just me, man, I'd love a spot up in North Carolina, like kind of the foothills of the mountains there. Yeah, that'd be kind of where it's at for me.
I'm with you. Kate and I, we're totally all about Western North Carolina. So I think what that means, though, is maybe in 20 years, when you guys have your beach house, we've got our mountain house, we do little swapsies, and everybody's happy. So,
yeah, once that FaceApp picture becomes reality.
Well, that's like when we're 80. Hopefully, it'll be way before then.
Let's
right?
hope so.
Like 60 at least.
Okay, all right.
If not, maybe 50?
I like your optimism, buddy.
Yeah, just keep my head in the game.
All right, we got a couple more questions we're going to get to, and we'll hit those up right after the break.
All right, Joe, we are back from the break, and now we have a quick question about credit cards.
Hi, guys. This is Cheryl in Ohio. I love your podcast. My question is about applying for a new credit card. My credit history is great. I have plenty of money in the bank and in my 401k, but I'm retired, and my income is zero. So when I'm applying for a credit card, the question about how much money you have coming in, I answered zero and I got turned down. I'm not surprised. Am I supposed to try to figure out what my possible income is if the stock market is good that year? You know, what am I supposed to do to get a new credit card? Thank you. Bye.
Cheryl, thanks for listening and thanks for submitting this question. You know, this is kind of something that a lot of us have to deal with when it comes to submitting our income information to credit card companies. And a lot of us have been getting notifications when we log into our accounts and the credit card company is asking, what's your income? And we have to decide whether we want to tell them the information at all, or much less report accurate information, which I don't condone lying, but it's something that people struggle with. They're not even sure whether they should fill out the form when the credit card companies prompt them.
I normally just click no thanks.
Yeah, I do too.
Remind me later.
Yeah, but sometimes like they're persistent and they continue to want that information. And so an interesting thing to note is that if you are a current customer of a credit card, you don't have any obligation to share your income information with the credit card company. But if you're signing up for a credit card, you do have an obligation when they ask you to tell them what your income is. And Cheryl, I'll tell you this, you are definitely going to be turned down for any credit card if you tell them that you have an income of zero. Their number crunching algorithms don't really like that. Basically, these companies want to know that they aren't approving someone who's not going to be able to pay the bill at the end of the month.
Yeah, and Cheryl, you actually do have income. That's the thing. If you're retired, you'll have income from Social Security and from that 401k that you mentioned in your message. You may not have earned income, but you have unearned income. That's the term that the IRS calls it. And that totally counts when it comes to filling in that information there on the credit card application.
Yeah. Otherwise, how are you paying your bills? How are you paying for your rent or mortgage? Or maybe you're mortgage debt free, which is great. But you have other bills in your life that require some sort of income. And you have that income coming in if you're retired. And you pretty much have to have some sort of income coming in, even if you're retired, right? So my best suggestion would be to estimate what your annual income is going to be. Maybe you're recently retired and you're not 100% sure what it is going to be yet. Well, give it your best shot. Calculate your annual withdrawal amount from your 401k plus your average monthly Social Security check over the last 12 months. And write that number in. It doesn't need to be spot on. They're looking for a general number of the place where you think that you are when it comes to annual income.
Yeah, Joe, they're looking for a ballpark figure because, you know, you're applying for a credit card, not necessarily to get a mortgage. Or this isn't, you know, the IRS where you're reporting your earnings to where you would be jailed if, you know, the numbers were slightly inaccurate. And, you know, for me, this is something I actually have to do being self-employed. My income varies sometimes pretty significantly.
Yeah, if you're counting your last 12 months versus your projected future 12 months, it can be completely different.
Yeah, exactly. Or sometimes just the previous year would have been a slower month and man, I may not get approved. And so honestly, in those instances, I just average my past few years kind of off the top of my head, or I just put down whatever I made the previous year. You want to get close. You don't want to overrepresent how much you make because you're not trying to get approved for maybe a business card that's got like a $20,000 or $30,000 limit, something crazy like that. But you want to enter in some information that is accurate enough to the best of your knowledge.
Nicely stated, Matt. Accurate enough to the best of your knowledge.
Sometimes I say pretty things.
You should be a lawyer or something, man. That sounds like lawyer language.
Yeah, I should not be a lawyer. I'll tell you that.
I don't want to be represented by you. I'll tell you that. All right, let's get to our next question about bankruptcy.
Hey, Joel. Hey, Matt. It's Richard from Philadelphia. A friend came up to me not too long ago telling me he's going to file for bankruptcy. He's in his mid-20s and he feels he is too deep in debt to climb himself out of. I don't know his financial situation in detail, to be honest, but he asked me my opinion, and then he came to me, I don't really know much about bankruptcy at all, but I told him I'd get back to him about it. I know it's not a clear-cut yes or no answer, but I'd like to know more detail about the positives and negatives, and the stigmas it holds now. Since I have a little more time, I thought I'd squeeze in a beer suggestion for you guys. Up here in the city of Brotherly Love, we have a brewery called Evil Genius. They have a load of fantastic beers with creative and hilarious names. Definitely check out the names, you won't be disappointed, I promise. My girlfriend and I's favorite has to be hashtag I can't even. All right, see you guys and go birds.
Richard, thanks for your question, man. And thanks for the beer recommendation. I always appreciate hearing about good new beers. And I did take your suggestion and look through some of the names of the beers for that brewery. And my favorite would be the hashtag Adulting Guava IPA. That's nice. What I go for.
That's kind of, I mean, that's sort of the namesake of our podcast, right? Like How to Money. When we talked about that name, we sort of mentioned it alongside adulting. It's sort of that noun that we use as a verb. And adulting is up there next to the verb of moneying, sort of. So we went with How to Money.
They go hand in hand.
They do. And I'm glad you actually looked up some beers because I did as well. And I had two favorites, one of which was Bye Felicia, which is totally one of their beer names, which I loved. And another one was hashtag Asking for a Friend, which is completely appropriate because that is what Richard is doing with us today.
Oh, so true.
Yeah. So Richard, bankruptcy is not the worst idea ever. There's a great article that Joel stumbled upon that we will link to in the show notes talking about how bankruptcy has helped some individuals. But, you know, having a fresh start can really help not only with your financial sort of state, but it can also dramatically help your mental and your emotional life. It's amazing what some breathing room and some margin, especially some financial margin, what that can do for your overall health.
Yeah. And Matt, that article you mentioned, it was a Fast Company article. And there were a few people that spoke about how bankruptcy had been really good for them and their families. And I think there is a negative connotation often that gets associated with bankruptcy. And for good reason. It's a very tough thing. It's hard on your credit. It's hard on your family. It's hard on your finances. I mean, there's so many reasons that bankruptcy is a difficult thing to go through. But one thing that needs to be stated is that, especially if you're filing for Chapter 13 bankruptcy, it allows you to maintain some normalcy by keeping your car and your house.
Yeah, essentially one of the outcomes is that it allows you to continue to earn money and be productive, right? Like if you still have your car, you can still get to work. You still have a place that you can call home. You can still come home after work and recharge and sleep, but it still keeps you in the game, essentially. It's not like bankruptcy is completely wiping you off the map.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that it should be a moral obligation to pay your debts if at all possible. I think bankruptcy is a big decision, and it should be kind of your last option. You have to be willing to walk through the consequences of a bankruptcy over a long period of time, because it can be a long process. It's not as quick as hitting like the reset on your old school Nintendo, right?
I remember that.
little button press, you start over.
Incredibly easy to hit.
Right.
Sometimes I would just hit it with my big toe.
Gross. But yeah, there's...
Oh, you did it too.
Maybe. Yeah, essentially a bankruptcy sticks around on your credit file for 7 to 10 years. And with your credit messed up like that, you're not going to be able to get a mortgage for a long time. And depending on the levels of debt that your friend has, well, trying to work with your creditors directly might be the best option. And it could help you maintain a healthy credit score for those other purchases that you hope to make in the more near-term future.
Yeah, because if you don't have that healthy credit score and you get a loan, man, those interest rates might be sky high. And so a rule of thumb to consider is whether or not your unsecured debt, whether that be your credit cards, medical debt, personal loans, all of that, whether or not that is 50% or more of your annual take-home pay. If your unsecured debt is over that threshold, that is when you're going to want to consider bankruptcy.
Yeah, that's a good rule of thumb to kind of help you know how bad things actually are. There's a good middle ground, though. It's hard to attack your debts when you're feeling overwhelmed and disorganized. Getting some good financial counseling can be really helpful to you in a situation where you think bankruptcy is an option that you need to consider. And nfcc.org is the best place to turn for that counseling. So I would tell your friend to find your local NFCC affiliate. That'll help him get a good idea of whether he needs just budget help, maybe even some debt consolidation help from someone at the NFCC, or whether bankruptcy is actually his best option.
Yeah, and Joel, you know, bankruptcy counseling, it's actually mandatory within 180 days before you file for bankruptcy. So that's something that he's going to have to do anyway. So maybe encourage your friend to go into that meeting with the hope to not file bankruptcy if he's able to get some great tips, maybe some organization, even just someone to talk to and some encouragement to tackle those debts.
Yeah, there's a decent chance that the picture is a little bit rosier than he thinks it is. If he's thinking bankruptcy, I'm sure things are tough, but the folks at NFCC will be able to really help him put things into perspective, take a look at the numbers for themselves, and point him in the right direction. And there's definitely a chance that he can avoid filing for bankruptcy and make some of these harder choices based on the budget plan and debt consolidation efforts that the NFCC can offer him.
Nice, man. We have a couple more questions. One about an escrow account and another about investing in a Roth IRA as a student. But first, a quick break.
All right, Matt, we're back from the break. And first up, we've got a question that probably a lot of people have in the back of their minds. Why do we have an escrow account when we have a mortgage?
Hey, Joel and Matt. My name is Dallas, and I'm from North Ogden, Utah. I have purchased two homes in the past, and I have always used an escrow account for my property taxes and insurance. My wife and I are thinking about moving again, and I am trying to decide if having an escrow account is better or worse than just paying the bills on my own. I'm very organized with money and feel comfortable saving and paying the bills without falling behind. The pros I see to not opening an escrow account are that I can accrue interest on the money in a high-yield savings account rather than the bank keeping that interest. Also, I could potentially pay these bills with a credit card, which only reaps additional cashback rewards since I always pay my balance in full each month. The cons I see are losing the convenience of someone else handling my bills, which is not important to me, and the possibility of paying a waiver fee so high that it cancels out all the interest savings over the life of the loan. But I plan to put down 25%, so maybe that waiver fee will become non-existent. That said, do you have a preference on opening or not opening an escrow account? I look forward to hearing your answer. Thanks.
Dallas, you mentioned North Ogden. We've actually had beers from there, so I'm guessing Ogden must be a very cool spot. But let's go ahead and get to your question. Let's talk about escrow accounts. I have personally always used an escrow account, and mostly it's because of simplicity. The first time we ever bought a house, I brought that question up actually at the closing table, and I said, wait a minute, like, why do you hold all the money and why don't I just get the bill? But our realtor specifically just said, oh, you don't want to worry about that. Just let the bank take care of that and you won't have to worry about it. But Dallas, I'm with you. I'm with you there in spirit. I like where your head's at, and this is a great question.
Yeah, Dallas, you mentioned being organized. Well, that is one of the crucial things if you're going to pay taxes and insurance separately. We love the idea of you getting those extra rewards and interest, but we're probably only talking about, what, a few $100 a year at most?
Yeah, unless you're getting one of those, you know, major sign-up bonus cards. Yeah, you're just talking about a few $100.
Yeah, so it's just not necessarily worth it unless you are incredibly organized and you're willing to take on that increased responsibility and paperwork by doing it yourself.
An important point to bring up, Dallas, you mentioned the waiver fee. That's something that maybe a lot of folks don't know about, which is that one-time fee, that charge, that the lender will charge you if you decide not to set up an escrow account. Basically, the reason they charge you that is because it's in the bank's or it's in the lender's best interest to make sure that that money is set aside so that when your insurance bill shows up, that it gets paid. That when your tax bill shows up, it also gets paid. They don't want to have an interest in a home that doesn't have home insurance or that has a lien against it because the government is looking for a bill to be paid. But you can try and negotiate with your lender as part of closing to see if they can knock that out for you. And if they say no, then just compare that waiver fee to how much you could potentially make in interest and rewards, like you said, over the term or the length of time that you expect to be there. At this point, it really does become a pretty easy math equation because when you can compare numbers to numbers, it makes it a lot easier.
And Dallas, because of the way you worded the question, it really is a math equation. For most other people, it comes down to inconvenience. It comes down to, am I actually going to pay the bill? Most people choose to have an escrow account because it's easy. And if you're willing to forego the ease and the automation that an escrow account provides in order to make a better return on your money by taking it into your own hands, I say more power to you, man. I say go for it if the math works out in your specific situation.
Nice, Joel. All right, we've got one more question. And this one was submitted to us by a listener who was looking out for her sister, which totally tugs at my heartstrings. Having three daughters, I would love to think that my daughters would be looking out for each other like Olivia is.
Hey guys, this is Olivia from San Francisco, California. And my question is for my younger sister, actually. She's 20 and she's in college. I want to get her investing in the market as early as possible, even with the limited funds that she does have currently. But my first thought was getting her a Roth IRA account. But I, you know, did some research and a lot of the main companies require kind of a minimum initial deposit or a minimum recurring deposit. And that's just not really possible given that she doesn't have a steady source of income yet. So I was just wondering what your advice would be for this. My first thought was to open a Robinhood account and kind of get her invested in some ETFs there, but would love to hear your thoughts. Thanks so much.
Olivia, you're a good sister. I have to say that. Helping your sister with something like investing at the age of 20, that's like big sister of the year stuff right there. That's for sure. And getting her started that early, not only from a standpoint of compounding growth, but from a standpoint of her mental approach to investing by having grown accustomed to doing it from such an early age, That's huge. So seriously, mad props to you for getting the ball rolling for your sister. And there are companies that don't have forced minimums for you to open an account. So we'll get into that. I wanted to mention, you talked about Robinhood and you said that that's kind of where you are leaning towards opening an account for your sister. And Robinhood is a great app. And there are tons of folks out there who are investing their money via Robinhood, including a lot of our listeners. But I will say they don't allow you to open a Roth IRA. And that's my sticking point with Robinhood. If they would make retirement accounts available, then I would be much more apt to give people that recommendation. One of our favorite investing apps is M1, and they're very, very similar to Robinhood. It's mostly app-based with a slick interface, but they do offer access to retirement accounts like IRAs. Although I gotta mention, they have a $500 minimum, which might be too much for your 20-year-old sis. And Vanguard is another one of our favorite recommendations, but oftentimes they require a $1,000 minimum to start investing as well.
Yeah, Joel, we love both M1 and Vanguard. They do have those minimum deposits, but they don't have minimum recurring deposits. So that's definitely a plus with those. However, our favorite place for beginner investors to go check out that does not have minimum deposits or monthly deposit requirements is Fidelity. They've got zero fees, no minimums, plus they have that portfolio of zero cost funds, which means that they are completely free to invest in, which is fantastic.
Those zero cost funds are awesome, man. Fidelity has just done a killer job with those.
It's like retirement 3.0, you know, like totally up on their game. So Olivia, you definitely want to send your sister in the direction of one of those three, either Fidelity, Vanguard, or M1.
Yeah, Matt, all three of those are just awesome places to get started with your investing. And they're places that you can feel really comfortable investing for the long term, which is great. I did want to mention, Olivia, that you mentioned that your sister is in college and she's only 20 years old. And there are a lot of 20-year-olds who are in college that aren't working while they're in school. So if your sister is one of those, if she doesn't have a job, if she doesn't have earned income throughout the year, well, she's just not going to be able to invest in a Roth IRA. One of the requirements of contributing to a Roth is having earned income every year. So if she's got a part-time job or works during the summer, well, she can contribute up to the amount that she makes. And because her tax liability is likely insanely low, if not non-existent, contributing to a Roth when you have that low of an income is one of the greatest things that you could do. So yeah, if it's possible, if she has earned income, make a Roth IRA the definite priority. If not, it might make sense to just open up a brokerage account for her to get her started down that investing path.
Yeah, Joel, great advice. And again, Olivia, I think this is just fantastic that you're thinking of your little sister, right? Joel, did your big sister impart any financial sage wisdom on you when you were in college?
No, she didn't. But one of the nice perks of being her brother was she was a lifeguard at a local water park.
Oh, Whitewater?
Yeah, Whitewater. Nice. Yeah. Which is this major water park. People know it around the Southeast. And she worked there. And so, yeah, I got to say, I got free entrance for a little while, which was nice.
Not quite on the level of Roth IRA, but I'm sure at the time you were all about that.
Oh, yeah. It was so good. It was so good. I haven't been there in forever. I got to take the kids there one of these days.
Oh, yeah, totally. Get them on the Dragon's Tail. Was that there when you were a kid?
Yeah. Everyone said it hurt their back, but I had the best time.
You totally catch air and like smack into the plastic.
Totally. Exactly. So, yeah, Olivia, by the way, getting your sister started is huge. And once she gets that first job out of school, she can start contributing to a 401k, 403b, you know, whatever she has access to at her first job. And just know that like you helped make this happen because you got her started early. You put it on her radar. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems, Matt, for people in their early to mid 20s is it's just not even on their radar.
It's not something that's really talked about.
No one's ever told them, hey, you should do this. Hey, this is important. Hey, this is going to make a big difference in your future. And you being the big sis that basically tells her those things, that's huge.
Yes, that's right. Let's switch back over now to our beer that we had on this episode, which was Moku Imperial IPA by Lanikai Brewing Company. And you know what? This isn't by Kona or Maui, those other fake Hawaiian beers.
What fake?
I don't know. I feel like that's one of the things that Cody mentioned was that this is the real Hawaiian beer. So I'm excited to have tried this one. And what were your thoughts on this?
Well, I will say, I don't think Kona's fake, okay? I've been to the actual brewery.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And it was good.
Well, all I know is that I've seen it on the shelves at Target. So I don't know.
That's true. They've gotten a lot bigger since I went there. Much, much bigger because they're all over the U.S. now.
They've done a good job with distribution.
Yeah. But this one was really good, man. I really enjoyed this beer. It's not often you get to try a Hawaiian beer that isn't mass produced and mass distributed. So big thanks to Cody for sending this one our way. I really enjoyed the floral notes and some nice IPA bitterness. This one tasted a lot more like that traditional West Coast style IPA. And my final note on this beer, it tasted like a luau.
Oh, I like that. Are you bringing back the one word descriptive? Because we did that for a while and it kind of ended up being awkward because I think we were sort of forcing ourselves to say a singular word just to get through it, right? But I kind of see what you're saying though. There's some floral notes there, and with this being a double IPA, there's a lot of flavor packed in there with the hops. So I'm with you, man. I really enjoyed this one, and I am looking forward to another beer that Cody sent us that we're going to enjoy on Wednesday's episode.
And you know, floral notes, putting a lay on somebody.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was referring to.
So Hawaiian, yeah. Right? So yeah, thanks Cody for sending this one our way. We really appreciate it, man.
And Joel, let's not forget about our book giveaway from last Monday's episode. This was Cameron Huddleston's book, Mom and Dad, We Need to Talk, How to Have Essential Conversations with Your Parents About Their Finances. So all folks needed to do was to give us a follow on Instagram and then shoot us an email to let us know. So we've got our winners picked out, and they are Bill Dozer, 48, and Twisty Crisp. We'll be reaching out to you two shortly. Thanks to everyone for giving us a follow and entering the contest.
All right, Matt, that's going to be it for this episode, my friend. And if folks want show notes for this episode or just to kind of read some of the articles that we've been publishing on the site, you can check that out on our website, howtomoney.com.
And normally we ask you to leave a review over on Apple Podcasts. And while we appreciate that, you know what's more fun is to actually talk about financial topics with a friend or a family member. Just share it with someone you care about.
Or in our tribal, really. Either way.
Yeah, it can be fine. A friend of me. Either way. All right, Joel. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.